Wandering Fathers. This is Carl Fansteel.
And Elliot Fansteel, the father.
Yes, indeed. The father has a new mic today.
Pretty, pretty.
So I was down at my favorite used music shop, shout out Atomic Music in Beltsville, Maryland, right next to the University of Maryland, if you're ever in the area. Great shop, great owners. And I was trying to get rid of some gear that's been sitting around forever in my studio because it's a cluttered mess in here. And I saw it and I went, this is the kind of broadcaster mic that you deserve. And so now you look probably cooler than me. Not that you always haven't looked cooler than me, but your mic has a neat, like...
My mic's bigger than your mic.
Uh-huh, sure.
I just want to say, we've settled it, finally.
Yours is hanging sideways. Describe, what does your microphone look like?
Only sometimes.
What does your new microphone look like?
Well, it's shiny, and it's black shiny. It's got the perforated end on one on the left, and on the right it's just solid. And the CR77.
It's kind of like a pill shape, you know?
It is a pill shape. It reminds me of pills I used to take. In fact, in my youth, there was a thing called the Black Beauty.
Oh, goodness.
It was basically speed. But you took one of those and you were good for, you know, for a couple hours.
This is like one of those things you find at a truck stop?
You know, it was like something I got from my secretary at the time, who was, you know, a provider of many things.
Your secretary is just like, I can type 500 words a minute.
Well, I think I might have just met Cindy because she was very anti anything like that.
Good for you, Mom.
It didn't last long. And also, I don't know how anybody could sustain on that. I mean, you just burn out.
I imagine the crash is pretty brutal.
Right. So now as I speak into this microphone, all those things come streaming back to me. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Black Beauty will be the name of your microphone.
Okay.
The other Black Beauty that we're drinking is we are enjoying a cup of Zeke's coffee.
Ah, this is Zeke.
Right here in Maryland. Shout out Zeke's. Not sponsored, but we'd be happy to be. And Zeke's is notoriously known for being a very well-caffeinated brew.
Yes, it's dark. It's full-bodied. It's a serious coffee. It's coffee saying, hey, you can't ignore me.
That's right. This is
once I get inside your body, you're ramped.
If it had an alcohol equivalent, this is like knocking down a martini after work.
Right.
This is that coffee.
But you're not quite so giddy.
No, not even a little. Well, we're off to a great start. Beautiful Tuesday. Toby on the floor being a good boy. And it's sunny because that's what happens on Tuesdays.
And it's finally actually chilly. I was just checking, asking you how your heat is in this new abode.
It's holding in there. It's breezy as well. I've got branches down in the yard.
Okay.
So, well, welcome back, everybody. I guess we made it to episode 6.
We actually have listeners.
I know. We've been getting feedback from a couple of friends and super appreciate that. So if you want to reach out and let us know how we're doing, suggestions, thoughts, you know, death threats, you can find us at Wandering Fathers or wanderingfathers@gmail.com. I'm waiting for those emails to come in. One of these days, someone will surprise me with an email. An address I won't recognize, you know, a new person. So we were talking a little bit before the show about, you know, what does a holiday schedule look like for new fathers and then its role in fatherhood, because I'm having a turkey baby. November 21st is our due date. And I'm not quite sure that Thanksgiving is going to happen for at least my side of the troop here.
Something will. It might just be pieces of family dropping by, dropping through. We have been known in our household to do the big everybody around the table thing. Cindy will open the door to anybody, even if she doesn't know them. So it's always been a gala. However, this one, because we just had the big family party that pretty much took care of the Carter side of it and a fair number of fan steals, it's unlikely we'll be putting all the energy into getting people here. We're opening our doors to those who show, but not making it a big deal.
Gotcha.
So it'll be a modester version of the usual turkey fest.
Good. So if there was one turkey, non-turkey related item, a Thanksgiving side, that if nothing else, come hell or high water, you had to have, what would it be? Think hard. You only get one choice.
We're talking food?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love a good stuffing.
Yeah.
And there's so many different variations. Now, the problem is I married a woman who only knows there's one variation, at least one approved one.
What's the approved one?
Oh, it's pretty straightforward. You know,
it's a bread-based stuffing.
It's a bread-based stuffing. Now, I would be a Pepperidge Farm guy because my mother did that, and it has a much more full-bodied, highly seasoned quality to it.
They use like the chicken herbs in that one.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, you get these white cubes of nothingness that turn mush. So I'm definitely in the Pepperidge Farm camp.
Stuffing in or out of the bird?
Ah, well, this is interesting because it's always been in the bird. Then I start reading about how all kinds of bad things get transferred when it's in the bird. I don't care. I still like it in the bird. It's got the juices.
I think the idea is, like, can you get salmonella or something of the sorts because it's undercooked inside? I think that's all it is, right?
I guess so. But cook it enough, then. That's all I say.
I am a fan of a cornbread and sausage-based stuffing.
Oh, nice.
Right? That nice. Eats its on its own.
Now, I like cornbread, too. Cindy will not have cornbread. That's
sacrilege.
Thanksgiving.
I understand. See, I'm all about the avant-garde Thanksgiving. I'm like, let's do it real weird. You know,
or maybe we should claim a Thanksgiving and say, don't worry, we'll cook.
Well, years ago, we actually did. It was an experiment.
Among the children?
No, among Kate and I. We broke off for one Thanksgiving and did with two friends, with Mike and Jennifer. And we went to this cool little house in Middle River and we brought a case of wine and locked ourselves in this house for 48 hours. And we Thanksgiving, and it was delicious, and it was not traditional. We were very choosy about each item here, and it was a nice time. But
what kind of items did you?
Everything was just like glitz stuff, right? Like the cranberry couldn't just be cranberry; it was cranberry and prosecco with orange zest. Get it?
Got it.
The turkey wasn't. I don't think we did a whole bird. I'm pretty sure that it was like a bacon wrapped like turkey breast, like just that, you know. So we really did like the food and wine version. Thanksgiving. It was a delight. I don't remember much of it either because we were like heavily sleepy and inebriated the entire time, but it was an amazing time. I will always look back on what I do remember of it fondly. I think if I had to choose a Thanksgiving side I could not go without, it would be the cranberry. It's not Thanksgiving without the cranberry. And I like cranberry in all its forms. Did I cut you off?
No, I was trying to think, what about the cranberry? Is it just a standard cranberry, orange zest?
I like a cranberry sauce that is chunky with the actual berry skins
right,
in it.
Agreed.
I also like that canned log.
The jelly?
I love that. I can't explain it. And I'm weird about texture. I don't love most gelatin type of things, but for that one, it's grainy. And you know what I really like is that it's sour and it's bright. And
it is sour.
Cuts through everything
on else
table.
On the plate, which isn't.
And I think that's
sweet
why
potatoes with
yeah.
marshmallows and all that. It just cuts right through and gives you back your taste buds.
So now I'm sad because we've talked about this, and Kate's like, "Oh, there's not going to be a Thanksgiving." I even said I'm going to make like a little Thanksgiving dinner, and she told her friends, and they're like, "No, he's not." And now I'm kind of feeling like I really want Thanksgiving this year.
You know, you only get one a year.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, nothing's stopping me from making it a week later or a week before. I suppose I could still have it without having it on day of. Well,
you're invited, of course, to ours if you're vertical and moving.
I'll be vertical.
Well, you're always invited to ours, of course. Yeah. But I'm just saying it's going to be a little more modest than usual.
I don't think that we have any problems with that. I mean,
but I do think there's a different role for men at Thanksgiving.
Okay, how so?
Just to, get on the topic of the show.
Please, I'd like that, because we've been talking about turkey for 5 minutes.
It's one holiday where, by tradition or by fiat, the guy is at the head of the table, and he's generally the one who does the prayer. Make it up, use a popular one, whatever.
Okay.
But for 10 minutes, he's got the floor. And nobody contests that.
10 minutes?
Yeah, about 10 minutes. I mean, that's how long a standard benediction, plus the lead-in and the outgo, we're so happy to see everybody together today, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so on this one day, you get to be the, priest of the affair, to talk about what's good, what's special, what's memorable, about the connections between all the people. And so it's just a little deeper than, let's eat. And I like that. I like it. It's momentary. There's nothing, no blessing that keeps you going an hour later. But for that moment in time, everybody's looking, and at least they're thinking to themselves, I better be good for okay. the next 5 minutes.
I'm 50-50. I love the idea of taking moments to enjoy each other's company and be thankful. I think that that moment isn't lost. I hate, oh, do I despise the whole everybody go around the table and say something you're thankful for.
I know, we never did that.
It's happened a few times.
At our
table? I'm not going to say that you started that.
And not at our table.
At the old Carter tables, plural, because it was like three tables. That happened once or twice.
Okay.
It's
but that's so many people. My God, it must have taken all afternoon.
I'm just saying. It's not a great tradition. If I never do that again.
What's a better question?
I don't think it's a question. That's I don't like turning the Thanksgiving table into a game show. that's what it comes down to. And all your food's dying in front of you. So let's say something really great. Let's take a moment to think about everybody. Please take a moment. Think about what you're thankful for.
These cranberries.
Rub-a-dub-dub. Thanks for the grub. Boom. Right? And then go on into it. And I think just being present at the table, a very lost art right now, should be enough, you know, not have, you know, the Cowboys game on in the background or people with their phones, you know, duct tape to their face.
Well, the other thing is that Dad usually carves. So you got a big knife in your hand. Nobody's going to mess with you.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I don't think is that, you know what, I will give it this in the Plutonic sense. I do believe the father role has its traditions heavily routed right there.
Well, you can just see the guy wearing the pilgrim hat, right?
Totally. And I think that obviously is fading every day as society evolves.
That's true.
Yay, society.
That's true.
But I think that there's a hosting thing. I think it's generational, right? Typically, the eldest, like I told the story last week about my grandfather, Walt, and how he had to pass the utensils off to his firstborn son to go solve a NASA crisis. I think that there's a leadership thing there. I also don't think that you get to enjoy the holiday nearly as much when you're the host and or father. Like, you are the provider, not being provided for. Because my memories of Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever, was watching my grandparents and the older aunts and uncles really just kind of slave away in the kitchen for hours on end. And we were kids, so we just got to run around and do whatever the heck we wanted, right? And I know now, just after having hosted a few events here and in my old house too, man, you don't really get to rest. You are now the host. You are now in charge of other people's well-being and their good time too. You're creating the memories. And I like taking on that responsibility. That's one of my favorite parts of my perceived fatherhood.
In our family, we used to go to Rochester, New York, to my cousin's house, where it'd be one of those big tables, you know, because they had a bunch of kids. These were very smart. They're all smart people. We always felt inferior going up there. He went to Cornell and all this stuff. But there was one thing. There was the fan steel blessing that we had that somebody had carefully written down, and we passed it around. Everybody had a copy. Draw near the board with plenty spread, and if in their accustomed places you see the something bright and familiar faces of those who shared your childhood joys, et cetera, et cetera. And we would recite this, intone this, as if in a temple somewhere. And it was the one thing we all did together. We knew it was coming. We did it, and it was over. But it was the closest thing to a benediction our family ever got to year-round. There was no other moment quite so intoning of a longer story than just today.
Really?
Yeah. And so my sister Julie was the historian of the family. She carefully wrote this down. And Carla, I think Carla did too one time. And they would show up with 3x5 cards and pass them around. Everybody would have this. You don't remember that?
No, not even a little. But now I really want to know what it says.
We will find that.
Oh, can
so that
we?
You have that in your hand.
Oh, I'm gonna
whether you use it or not.
Learn how to. What's that thing where they stitch little weird crap onto the
on a pillow?
Yeah, I'm gonna stitch it onto a pillow.
I think that may actually already exist on somebody's pillow. I'll call Julia, find out. She knows.
Please
all
do
that.
I'm making a note.
Draw near the board with plenty spread is all you have to remember.
Near the board
with plenty spread.
All right. It's been
which
noted.
Always that was my mental picture of Thanksgiving: mounds of food. And my cousin Steve Geppert could eat a ton, and he'd come out of the kitchen. We also did a self serve in the kitchen, and the plate was, I mean, overflowing, every inch, several layers. And he would just sit down, didn't talk much, and just chow right through that thing. And I was always he was my big cousin, my older cousin. And I was, wow, I'm going to do that someday. I never got to that level of prodigious appetite. But I also remember my grandmother, Grandma Beau, my father's mother, stayed at the kitchen because we go up there and stay for a couple of days in Rochester, New York. And so we would sleep there overnight. And this big house had many floors, and I always slept with Steve up in the attic, which was way the hell up in the air.
This is reminding me of Home Alone.
It should. It should. Because Steve was kind of, I mean, he was a fine guy and everything. But, I mean, he built himself an air conditioner out of plywood and a fan and some kind of condenser material. Long story short, I came down for breakfast one morning, and Beau was down there, and she was having her morning coffee. And she was taking a handful of pills. I'd never seen so many pills in my life. I thought to myself, is that what's coming? And before I could even open my mouth, she said, "Someday this could be you."
And then she ate 20 Black Beauties.
Hers weren't anywhere near as much fun. But I, you know, I take a handful of pills every morning. Damn, you know, it's just weird to see what awaits, and to see it in the actual reality of a real person. And she was legendary, Beau.
We're gonna take a quick break. Last week, I asked you for suggestions about, you know, what a nice activity would be, and you mentioned a book that you read in the 70s, and it kind of changed your perspective on all things, including parenthood, fatherhood, called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And true to term, you showed up today having unearthed a copy that literally looks like it came out of the Cold War.
Which would mean it came out of my house.
That's right. And it had your scribblings, too, in it, and it looks well-loved. What was revisiting this text like?
Well, thank God for my wife, who knew where to find it. We had redone our library, and we'd thrown out a lot of books. Now, I would never throw this out. In fact, there's another copy. I know there's another copy somewhere in our house, because I got entranced with this book, and I started giving it out. The one that I have here turns out, much to my chagrin, to have a page-long opening dedication to my girlfriend at the time, who I later married, and that only lasted a couple of years. And I was trying to say, here's me in a nutshell. If you see the beauty in this, if you understand any of this, you'll get me.
And how'd that work out for you?
It was a total failure. I don't think she read it. I don't think she ever really responded to it. I have no record of any. In fact, if I hadn't found this, I wouldn't believe that I had done it.
You took the copy back when you split, I'm assuming.
I must have. Or she gave it back or threw it at me. I don't know which. But I mean, that tells you why that marriage didn't work. I mean, she found nothing of solace, nothing of brilliant introspection, which is what I had expected her to find. She couldn't find any of it. So Clearly, I made a mistake in choosing that person, second in buying the book to give to her. I later did give this book to some other people. But let me go back for a second, because this was during a period of time when I lived the closest thing I'll ever live in to a commune.
Yeah, you told us about the commune last week.
I was in a suburban house with a bunch of other friends in the Street 70 Theater Company, one of whom was a guy named Will Robertson.
Hold on, let me say this real quick. Street 70 Theater Company. Little known fact about my father I'd like to put on the record is that he was heavily involved in directing and producing musicals. And a lot of the people that he hung out with were fun bohemian actors and dancers and musicians, my mother being one of them.
She moved into the house, and that's one way we got to know each other, so to speak. But she was fairly a latecomer to that process. Street 70 was started by a woman named June Allen, who literally put arts on the playgrounds of Rockville, hence Street, and it was 1970, named Street 70. It became the Roundhouse Theater when it moved into a real home. But it had a storied beginning of these six or seven very talented people, many of whom are still my friends today, Jerry Whidden, Irene, Lonnie, Michael Littman. And we were all in the house together, but one guy almost rode through town. If he'd had a horse, he would have just come up and tied off to the thing in front of the house and gone wahoo and come in. His name was Will Robertson, and this book, he introduced this book. You know, I think he introduced it to the house, but he certainly introduced it to me. I mean, we had a long talk, and he said, "You should read this." Well, Will was a little crazy, but he was also brilliant. And if he said I should read it, there was something there for me to read. So I did. Now, this book has, 450 pages, so it's not a light reading material. But it was, in fact, the story of a very bright man who went into a chapter of life with his son, which consisted of a motorcycle ride from Minneapolis to the West Coast. I don't remember why. I'm not sure we ever knew why he did it. But it was time with his son, and clearly he and his son had a lot to work out. His son was on the edge of insanity. I mean, he'd had some real psychological problems, lose his temper. And they were traveling with another couple who were just stunned at the anger that this young boy had. But they understood that this was sort of a trip so that dad could be with son, reassure son, give him another alternative he could live in. But the whole thing is told through the story of riding on this motorcycle to the West Coast. And along the way, they're going through hot deserts and cold nights and all the torture that motorcycles submit you to as part of the adventure. And he has an answer for everything because he appreciates the motorcycle as a structure, an organized set of principles. He has what he calls the classical and the romantic view of it. And he's trying to explain to his son along the way and to the male partner who was driving with him, who would not touch a wrench if he had to, who would just find the nearest mechanic and say, "Fix it." Not this guy. This guy wanted to fix it. He wanted to know why it's broken, what's wrong with it, what needs to be fixed. And it was the beauty of that fix, of that understanding the inner workings of the motorcycle that gave it its beauty. So now you have a guy who's really understanding life through the eyes of a system of mechanical pieces that has a greater purpose as a whole. And that's what he's trying to explain to the world. That's what he's explaining to his son and to this other couple falling on deaf ears. In the course of that book, in the course of that trip, he keeps coming across metaphors to his life. And what happened is that the person that he used to be, whose name was Phaedrus, has now ceased to exist and yet also exists because he is the protagonist in a former life or in a former life of this life. And then he had gone insane. He had had shock therapy, had been hospitalized, came out, and now only dimly remembers Phaedrus. But the rediscovery of Phaedrus and how he was different from who this man is now is the story. If that sounds confusing, it is. and never does it really get more clarified than knowing that he used to be Phaedrus, he's not anymore, and his son has many of the same features that he thinks Phaedrus went crazy from.
And so he's seeing himself in his son, or his past self in his son.
And his past self in his future son. Because his son is trending that direction. And actually the book ends and you don't know, but...
Oh, it's like Inception? The top just keeps spinning?
It just keeps spinning. You're like, oh my God.
Oh, sorry. Spoiler
there is a
alert.
Resolution at the end that makes you feel better, but it's not a deep one. And anything that had happened could happen again, you know. So the complexity of the book is all about the relationship between the father and his son. But as a father, he's not very good. I mean, most of his thought time is what's happened to him, not his kid. And when his kid has a problem, he's very impatient with his son because to him, it sounds like whining. In fact, the son is trying to find a reality that he can live with. And so it's a deep book. It's not an easy thing to read. I will say that if you don't have any appreciation for motorcycles, it's a hard book to get into because, you know, why did that plug foul when it got above 105 degrees? These are the kind of mysteries that he does unravel, but and he has a very classical understanding of not just the motorcycle, but its place in the world. And if you can explain that problem, why the point on that motorcycle has worn down in high heat, something about yourself is also getting fixed.
Got it.
That's the metaphor.
So would you say this is books about healing?
Well, I thought it was going to be about fatherhood, which is why I went back to it. And to some degree it is. That's you know, it's father and son on a motorcycle. It's really not about fatherhood. It's really about life. It's really about a classical view of why do we live and a romantic view of why do we want to live.
Oh, wow.
And that gets into the heavy stuff. And I don't recommend it for light reading. I do recommend it that if you chew your way through this book, you will feel nourished.
So
now you're going to go back and actually read it?
If I'm going to be totally honest with you, no.
No. Oh, my God. I
thought walking out of this, I would, too. I thought I'd be like, hey, leave that copy here, man. I will say this.
I'll leave this copy.
I'm positive, yeah. I'm positive you can extract a fatherhood lesson out of this book, though. So distill one lesson that you can move forward fatherhood-wise. What did pop out to you?
So at the end of the book, the kid says, Dad, can I have a motorcycle when I get old enough? Dad says, if you take care of it. Son says, well, what do you have to do? Father says, lots of things. You've been watching me. Will you show me all of them? Sure. Is it hard? Not if you have the right attitude. It's having the right attitude that's hard. Oh.
There you go.
To me, that's the most perfect single piece of advice about all the things that'll challenge you.
What page is this, by the way?
That's page 411. It's right at the end of the book.
There you go.
And the kid says, well, will I have the right attitude? And the father says, I think so. I don't think there'll be any problem at all. And so we ride on and on down to... the West Coast.
There it is.
That's all you can give.
They made you wait 100 pages or 400 pages. 400 pages. But they made it pretty clear there.
They absolutely did. And the fact that finally the kid wants it, that he's seen something about the beauty of the explanation, and now he wants it in his life, that's the success. That's the win.
I'm going to attempt to tie this into something that's been on my mind recently.
Go for it.
In my career path, I teach a lot of music, and there's this whole, you can't teach your own kid music thing. And so I get these parents.
Unfortunately, moms, my mother did that.
Totally. Moms and dads alike, and they come in, and you can tell, they know an instrument. Some of them have better theory than I do, but you can't tell your kid shit. Right?
Yeah, because it's discounted the minute you open your mouth. It must be something non-musical. It must be about life.
It's eat your peas. Yeah, it's one of those things. Yeah, it's right. Somewhere in that spectrum. It's somewhere, you know, in there. And these parents...
But what do you do?
I teach the kid. And
do you make the parent feel better, or do you just kick him out?
So I let some of the parents stay. A good friend of mine, I teach his daughter. His name's Chris. And he would stay in the room. And it's great because I have a guy and we're making, you know, fun, like, you know, theory jokes and talking about music that we like. You know, he's probably only got a few years on me. Some parents want nothing to do with it. And probably for the better. I wouldn't want them hovering over my shoulder, right? But to tie it back in, you can't teach your kid music because there is this... just natural, I need to push back on my parents, right? When they start to explore their space. So for the son in Zen to come back and go, could I have a motorcycle? After having gone on the journey, or after having been in the journey for a long time, does show, you know, he didn't teach his kid to want a motorcycle directly. He didn't force it upon him. The impact of being around it and in that environment made the son
and
seek
yet,
it.
And the truth that the father says is, if you have the right attitude, and that fits for music. You know, music is not something you're going to go borrow from somebody. It's something you have to find and own.
I'm desperately hoping. I always tell people when they ask, you know, what instrument do you play? And I'm like, a lot. It always comes back to your parenting. And I'm going to give mom credit on this as well. But I go, when I was young, my parents wouldn't buy me a Nintendo. All my friends had a Nintendo. But they would buy me any instrument I ever wanted or asked for. And they let us play 7 days a week, nonstop. And I think that created an environment and a habit for not just me, but my brother Eric, who to this day produces phenomenal music. Go check out Post Feedum on Spotify if you want to go hear the genius at work. My sister, who has a degree from Shenandoah in musical theater. My brother Mark, who's just a filthy musician, just doesn't practice music. He's incredible.
Yeah.
It's putting together an environment that's conducive to it and having it just around. Because neither of you or mom, both musicians, you know, flautist, mom, a piano player, never forced it on us, ever. It was always there. It was present. And it gave me... Well, it gave us this today, right? We wouldn't have this studio otherwise.
Well, that's how, when I grew up, my dad and my mother on Sunday afternoons would go down to the rec room where her piano was. Her piano was practically the altar of the house. I mean, it was just so special. It now sits in my living room, and I love that. But they would play 2-3 hours just paging through stuff. They were both very good at their instruments. Neither wanted to go perform. In fact, when my mother had to go do her own recital, and she's a piano teacher, do her own recital with the teacher she had who was still alive, she got such nerves that she couldn't do the show.
Really?
Couldn't perform. And yet she, you know, nurtured a million kids through this. My dad on the violin used to just go funky on it because what he really loved to do is tell violin stories to kids at a camp up in the mountains for blind kids. And he told a whole story about a castle manager and an evil castle manager and, of course, a beautiful princess. But he did it with a violin. And as he went up the steps, and the blind kids who couldn't see a thing but could hear the sound of the steps, he interpreted every character. And we would go with him to Marlow Ridge every summer. We would hear this violin scenario of a story that we all knew by heart by that time. But he was bringing music to life, pure love, no music, no notated music in front of him. And Margaret would sometimes get on the piano up there as well. So I only saw music loved. I never saw it forced.
And lo and behold, you end up in Street 70, literally directing musicals. I do believe there's this nurture to it, right?
There's something about let it happen as opposed to make it happen.
Yeah.
But where does the love come from? I do think that's psychically imbued by the parent and the child together.
Well, the one thing that I'm going to take full advantage of is during daytimes with my son, there will be music on at all times, all sorts of music. Because Kate, love her very much. Kate does not love music very much. And it's not that she's anti-music. She's anti-sound stimulus. She just doesn't like having music running in the background. She doesn't like to talk over it. And so I'm not going to lie, it chokes the environment for me a little bit, who's like, turn it on, leave it on. And so from the time she's at school till she gets home, I can have it just playing.
That should be sufficient.
It'll be great. It'll be absolutely great. I look
forward
to that.
And also, it's not just about playing music and having it in the air. It's try it. You know, it's rhythm instruments. It's whatever you can make music out of in the daily course of things. So if you can teach a song and use that on a regular basis, the kid making their own music is the moment.
I remember driving with you in a crappy little gold Camry on mornings up through Kensington into Rockville to your work. And we would listen to the same tape essentially every day, and we would harmonize over it. Do you remember this?
No, I remember
the tape. It was
throwing one out the window, but it wasn't.
That was a different tape. That was a hip hop tape. This was the Blenders.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I remember they had a rendition of Why Do Fools Fall in Love.
Still know it. Yeah.
And it was like a kind of like a barbershop quartet feel. But
it was classic happy music. Whatever your mood was, it was going to take you up three notches.
But I mean, I memorized that entire tape, and we would sing that thing in harmony every stinking morning. And it wasn't because we had to. It's just what we did.
Yeah.
And that was so special. And
I think music is the language of your family.
Totally.
That's the way to look at it.
I mean, certainly it's influenced our family heavily. I really hope to push that forward. And luckily, I did inherit some family members who are very musical, Kate's father and Kate's brother. I work with Kate's brother, and he, in our years at our music schools, picked the guitar back up and now is smoking player. He plays finger style. He has his fingernails grown out all crazy. And he does those really, really pretty, you know, classical renditions of songs. And then her father's like very like Return to Forever, you know, crazy complex jazz chord guy. He's a very, very good guitar player. And so and his brothers are essentially a jazz band. It's really, really impressive to watch. And so I have a very positive outlook on my future son's music influences.
Pearson will say that's all you need. Yeah. That if you have the right attitude,
good.
You can become what you want to be. But if you don't have the attitude, or if you think the attitude is beyond you understanding it, you'll never get past that. You'll be stuck. So you got the right attitude. And every time you touch one of your family members, and certainly your children, infect them with the right attitude, and they can do the rest.
That is true. Aw, you really got a heck of a message out of that book.
Well, I didn't know until I started talking to you, and that's the beauty of these podcasts.
That's the beauty. You did come in. You're like, yeah, I don't know where to get from this thing. I got a couple notes. I think
I kept waiting to turn the page and find truth. And it just wasn't there, except all these little nuggets.
Except on page 411.
411. Remember 411.
All right. Well, to wrap up, we need an activity for this week. And this weekend, I am having a party thrown for me.
Yes, you are.
Which
you
is rare. I throw parties. I don't typically have them thrown for me. Yeah. A couple, my brother-in-law and my good buddy Alec are putting together an event that I hadn't heard of up until a few years ago.
Me neither. Is this new?
I don't know, but I like it. It's called Huggies and Chuggies. And it's essentially where all of my friends show up with a six-pack of beer and a case of diapers. And we hang out all afternoon, watch football, and eat.
I've had a hell of a time finding diapers that'll fit you.
Oh, man. There's an aisle. There's an aisle
I actually know where those are.
So, because we have this on Sunday, and because the season is upon us, it was so brisk this morning. I was walking Toby, and I thought, you know what I'd like right now? Chili. I challenge you.
Good.
To a chili cook-off.
Oh, good.
You are to bring your best crock of chili.
Yes.
To Huggies. I will, too, bring my best crock of chili to Huggies. My panel of friends will vote. We will not say whose is whose.
Right.
And we will announce the winner next week. No rules on this chili, by the way. You want to go...
Beans, no beans, meat, no meat.
Whatever you want.
So it's a crock pot's worth.
Just a crock pot. Have it ready Sunday morning.
Do you need sides of any kind? Or
just bring a crock. And that way there'll be two crocks of chili at Huggies. So we're actually contributing to my party. And we get chili.
And we can smear some chili on one of the diapers and it'll really look like it's been used.
Oh, goodness gracious. And with that said, you can find us at Wandering Fathers. I will not post that picture on Instagram. Or you can email us at wanderingfathers@gmail.com.
Good, I like this one.
Thanks.
And the chill is in the air. It's time to make the chili.
That's right. Thank you for joining us. We will talk to you post Huggies and Chuggies next week.